seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 060778, City of El Paso et al. Versus Lily M. Heinrich.
May it please the court, Mr. Calhoun and Ms. Hutchin will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Calhoun will open with the first 14 minutes. Mr. Calhoun will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, Eric Calhoun here on behalf of the El Paso Fireman Policeman's Pension Fund, its Board of Trustees, and the individual trustees that have been sued in this case, along with the administrator of the fund. I'm here with Richard Prateritz, who's also on the brief with me. This appeal presents several overview issues, each of which has several subsidiary issues. So I'll address those, list those out first, address them in order.
Do your arguments or interests diverge in any way from the city's?
No, Your Honor, not with respect to this appeal. The first issue is whether or not a private party that has agreed with the determination by the pension fund concerning the amount of benefits that are due to that person under the governing bylaws and statutes for the pension fund may file a suit for declaratory judgment and injunctive relief against the fund and its trustees and individuals in order to seeking a declaration that the fund has violated those statutes or bylaws, and couple that with an injunction to compel essentially the payment of both past benefits and future benefits for that person. The second question is, what standard should the court apply in looking at a plea to the jurisdiction? Should the court look at the pleadings and the conduct of the officials and analyze that conduct in light of the governing law that governs the conduct and what those officials' obligations are in deciding to plead a jurisdiction? Respectfully, I think the court should do that, and the El Paso court did not. The third question here has to do with whether the individuals are immune from a suit here that is attempting to control their exercise of their discretionary duties in this case, whether they have immunity that's derivative of the governmental entities, and official immunity, where here the real claims are to order the governmental entity itself, here the pension fund, to pay the monies at issue. With respect to that first question, the question and subsequent to the El Paso court's ruling that's at issue here, this court decided the City of Houston versus Williams case earlier this year, which I think is instructive here. In that case, some firefighters sued the city seeking a declaration and other relief that they were entitled to recover monies for some back pay, sick leave, overtime monies that were not paid to them when their employment was terminated. As this court stated, clearly in that case, absent a clear and unambiguous waiver of immunity by the legislature, the city was immune from that suit. So even though it was cast as a suit for declaratory relief and injunctive relief, it's really a suit for money damages. And that's really what we have here. As respondent concedes in their brief, what they're really seeking here by way of this declaration, combination of declaration and injunctive relief, is an order from the trial court directing the pension fund, telling the pension fund that this is the way you are supposed to construe these provisions, and the construction of them requires a higher payment to respondent, and we're going to enjoin you from violating our construction of that provision. In essence, ordering you to pay back benefits allegedly due to Ms. Heinrich and future benefits in the future allegedly due under their interpretation. Respectfully, those claims are subject of governmental immunity.
And you don't differentiate between future payments and the past payments?
Respectfully, Your Honor, no. We believe that money is money, whether it's payable in the past or whether it's payable in the future. All of the principles that this court has identified in support of governmental immunity, the policy factors that go into a government deciding when it's going to spend the money, when it's going to require a governmental entity to defend against a suit for money. All those, the policy decisions, those are decisions that are properly made by the legislature, whether it's future monies or past monies. And there's really no appropriate distinction there between, for purposes of the governmental immunity from suit here, between future monies and past monies.
Well, would it be different if a governmental entity were legally obligated to pay money because of a judgment of a court?
Again, it would depend on how that got there, I would believe. The judgment of the court against the governmental entity, you would assume it would have had gone through the jurisdictional analysis as to whether that governmental entity had immunity from suit in the first place. As this court pointed out in Williams' case, immunity doesn't spring forth at the time of judgment. Governmental immunity from suit is a question that's addressed at the pleading stage before the governmental entity is required to spend the funds to address and defend that case.
What if she had been underpaid by mistake? The fund made a mistake, they wrote the wrong check. Could she sue then?
Absent a legislative waiver of immunity from suit, she could not prosecute a claim for money damages from the fund.
Well, the fund agrees that they owe her. They said, we owe you two-thirds, but they made an adding machine mistake. Put the decimal point in the wrong place or something. We owe you, but it's too bad you can't sue us.
Well, in that instance, the fund would do a calculation if agreed with her, would pay her. But from the standpoint of immunity from suit, again, absent the legislative immunity, a waiver of immunity, I would say no. As this court has reiterated, the door to the courthouse against a governmental entity is through the legislature. And that those the fairness and the public policy issues that are there would preclude a suit for money damages against a governmental entity.
What if in that instance there is a constitutional claim, takings claim, for example? She was owed this, the law compels it, and the city withholds or the fund withholds it. Would it be outside of our typical legislative waiver issue? If there's a constitutional claim, wouldn't that an avenue for suit?
If there were a valid constitutional takings claim, I think there's a different analysis potentially there. Here, however, there's no argument or no legitimate argument, and again, you've got to look at the pleadings and the law applicable to the circumstances. There's no legitimate argument here that there's been any constitutional right that can be redressed by a lawsuit that's implicated in this case. In fact, it wasn't really even argued to the Court of Appeals that way. So, in fact, I believe it was the City of Dallas versus Trammell case many years ago that held that pension benefits are not that are created by state statute and governed by the state regulations and pension funds are not a constitutionally protected property right. And so that analysis doesn't really apply to the circumstances of this case, in which we have a fund that's operating within its discretionary duties in implementing the bylaws that are applicable to this pensioner there at the time.
Public retirement benefits are protected by the Constitution. Has there been any argument in the case how that impacts the issues?
There really hasn't, Your Honor, been that issue raised as an avenue here. And we did brief the issue that there was no private cause of action for a constitutional violation here. And that was not a basis, though, for the underlying decision.
And then I was asking you several hypotheticals, but suppose that the bylaws that covered this said, as they do, two-thirds, but the pension fund forgot, and they forgot to change the bylaws, but they were running out of money, and they knew it was going to be a problem, so they said, yes, we forgot to change them, but we don't have the money, and we're just going to pay you one-third. and that's what we're going to pay. We admit that the law says this, but we're not going to do it. No cause of action there either.
Well, again, distinguishing, as this court has, immunity from liability, from immunity from suit. Again, the question of whether a governmental entity is liable is very distinct from whether they can be sued for it. And so here, with this admittedly state-created governmental entity, absent a legislative, clear and ambiguous legislative waiver of immunity from suit, there's not an avenue for a lawsuit for those money damages here.
What do you think of the state's position?
Well, I think that for the most part, the state's position is correct. They take the position, as we do, that you've got to, at the pleading stage, look at the conduct of the state actors in light of the applicable law to determine if there is a claim that has been properly pled that can proceed that is outside the scope of governmental immunity. And we agree that you've got to do that. They didn't do that here, and that, in fact, if you look at the conduct that's alleged here and the statutes, they acted within the scope of their authority. And so even if you don't, it's not a money damages claim, it's a claim to control a state official's actions within the scope of their authority and therefore barred by governing immunity. And we also agree with the state's position that this is, in essence, a claim for money damages, and therefore it's barred whatever frame of, whether you call it declaratory or injunctive relief. Where we disagree with the state is that there's some exception for what they would call a non-discretionary statutory obligation to pay, that in those cases you imply a waiver within the statute. And again, they don't cite any authority for that position. I mean, they cite to I.T. Davey, but it doesn't say that in I.T. Davey. Respectfully, this court has made it very clear that absent a clear statutory waiver, a clear and unambiguous waiver, consistent with the dictates of the Code Construction Act, the local government code that says that the legislature has said those things have to be there, you can't imply a waiver just because of an obligation by a government entity or agency to do something.
But you don't have to get to that argument because you say it was discretionary. Is that correct? Do I understand that right?
Under
the 1989 or 1980 bylaws.
Well, we don't get to that argument for several reasons. One of them is that the conduct that's alleged here was well within the scope of their discretionary acts as the Board of Trustees here by statute. That's what they were supposed to do. In fact, I think the bylaws say that they can't spend any money without a vote of the trustees. You know, so they've got a lot of other folks that they've got to account to besides Ms. Heinrich. So we don't get to that issue. And then so respectfully here, there is governmental immunity independent of that. The third issue, and again we've touched on the issue of whether or not what the court has to do or should do in considering the plea to jurisdiction, which is evaluate the conduct of the government officers in light of the standards that are applicable to them. And respectfully here, that's what should have been done. You look at the governing bylaws and statutes, you look at what the trustees did, and you say they were acting within the scope of their authority, and therefore it's not a claim that is outside the scope of government immunity. There's immunity from suit for that claim, and I believe that the Department of Agriculture versus Texas Printing Association case that's cited in the brief discusses some of that. It's very clear. The third area has to do with the individual's immunity, and here, where the claims are really, in essence, to compel the fund to take action and to pay money to the respondent, the claims are against the government entity, even if you sue the individuals. And so it's properly a suit against the entity, not the individuals, in which case the individuals have derivative immunity from suit.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will hear from petitioners, City of El Paso.
May it please the court, Hallie Hecton for petitioner, City of El Paso. Your Honors, we agree with the statements made in the brief by the fund, the petitioner, that there's been no waiver of governmental immunity because respondent is seeking monetary damages. The city does not administer the fund. It's administered by a board, but we have the same position as the fund that the principles of governmental immunity apply here and the city has not waived its governmental immunity. Looking at the petition, the respondent's petition itself shows that the respondent is seeking money benefits, money damages, and that means that sovereign immunity of the city has not been waived. This was a request for money judgment, money damages. Therefore, governmental immunity of the city has not been waived, and the city's plea to the jurisdiction should have been granted. Please answer any questions.
Thank you, counsel. The court will now hear from Amicus Curiae, the state of Texas.
May it please the court, Mr. Monson will present argument for the Amicus Curiae.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing Justice Hecht and Chief Justice Jefferson's questions about what's different between the state's position and the position of the petitioners. This case is not about an implied waiver of immunity. It's not about a waiver of immunity at all. It's about a long-standing common law exception to the immunity doctrine, which requires you to find that a state official or government official has acted so far outside of the zone of their discretion that they are no longer acting on behalf of the state, and that the lawsuit is therefore not one against the state and is therefore not barred by immunity. Now, there's two analytical questions you can ask to figure out whether this has happened. Is there a statutory or constitutional limitation on the government official's discretion that lets you know that this suit isn't actually a suit against the state? Or, and this is the second prong, and this is what IT Davey is about, would the court's judgment interfere in the discretion of a public body to allocate public money as it sees fit? And that's the heart of the difference between the state's position about the requirements of these pension programs and the requirements in the suit against the legislature.
But you say even if the act was ultra vires, if the end result is going to be spending money, that's the end of it.
Not entirely. We think that there are situations in which either the legislature can make the spending of money a non-discretionary obligation. For instance, if the legislature has already appropriated money to pay a certain claim and there comes into existence a legal obligation to pay that claim, then without doubt the comptroller could be mandamused or subject to an ultra vires suit to pay the money that the legislature has already allocated to that purpose. The bar on monetary damages is the interference with the legislature's discretion to allocate other monies in the budget as it sees fit.
But here, the claimant is either right or she's wrong.
That's right.
If she's right, the board, because the bylaws and the law say she's right, then the fund had planned on paying her.
And I think that's the distinction between suing a municipal local entity that's been created by statute and suing the legislature. The legislature has the power to create an obligation for state government but not fund it. If the legislature creates an obligation for one of these pension funds and there's a non-discretionary obligation to pay money, and I would challenge the merits of your hypothetical.
But if the bylaws said she wins.
Yes.
Just clearly. And the fund's already made that decision, and that's in the budget, you know, some fraction is going to go to this claim. Then she can sue it all.
She can sue, and she can get prospective relief requiring payment of the full amount owed to her under the bylaws in the future. We don't see any difference between this and the Morrow case, which involved minimum wages for firefighters. If the legislature says you have to pay so many dollars an hour to a firefighter and your local government entity, you have to find enough money to pay that minimum wage to all the firefighters.
And why not back pay?
Not back pay because the decision to allocate money means that they've already, if, for instance, the defendant in Morrow had already spent the money that should have gone to firefighter salaries on something else, the court's interference would challenge all of those discretionary allocations of money. But the affirmative obligation confirmed by the court to pay the money in the future comes into existence at the time that the judgment is entered. And after that, you could get an injunctive relief to enforce the already final judgment. And that's the federal rule in 1983 claims, which we think is analogous to this kind of situation. But once again, the ability for the courts to interfere in the discretion of a governmental defendant comes into existence only if the law creates a non-discretionary obligation on which the courts can base jurisdiction. But otherwise, the suits...
But the question is, we're looking back now to 1985 and saying, what was the obligation then?
Right.
And the fund thought it was this, and if we thought it was something else, wouldn't that be a non-discretionary obligation as of that time?
And it's our position that the jurisdictional analysis requires you to look at the bylaws and the statute and figure that out, because that's the only way you can know whether this is a suit against the errant official or a suit against the governmental entity itself, and that's how you figure out whether there's jurisdiction. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time to the court.
Thank you very much, Counselor. The court then is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Forbes will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. In 1985, that's when Chuck Heinrich died. Before that is in 1983 when he was shot. And the year before that, in 1982, is when he was given the Police Officer of the Year Award by the Combined Law Enforcement Association of Texas. The point I'm trying to make was the board, the pension board, decided it was such an unusual set of circumstances for a police officer to be shot in the line of duty. We're going back to the 1980s. That the violence that we have today is not such then as it is now, that the board got together with the city attorney and decided it was appropriate to give this widow 100% of the pension. Then comes, in the year 2003, the board then decides we're going to take this widow's money away from her. And go ahead.
My confusion about that argument is if they could disobey the bylaws in 1985, why can't they do it now?
I'm not so sure that they did disobey the bylaws in
1985. Well, they said two-thirds, one-third, and you said that it was so unusual they decided to have an exception. But the Section 20 doesn't say except if you're shot in the line of duty.
Well, the statute as brought forward by the petitioners say that the bail bond board, or excuse me, not bail bond, that was my last case before I was here. the pension board has the right to change it. So if that's correct, if that statute allows them to do it as the petitioners are brought forward, then they have the right to do it under these circumstances. Then it is legal. It was done by the city attorney. It was approved, and everybody agreed. We haven't been able to go into the trial court and develop the reasons why, other than what I've just told you, or their thought process as to why it was legal and why it applied to the bylaws.
But your argument is they could have changed it in her favor in 1985, but not change it back in 2002 or whatever.
Exactly, because the statute says you have to have vote by a certain amount of the then-paying members. They say you can only increase it, you can't decrease it. That's what the statute says. And my argument is this is her property. This board took it away. And in the Court of Appeals said you have to look at the underlying nature of the suit.
But how's that different from federal sign?
Sorry?
How's that different from federal sign? If Texas Southern Board approves we're going to buy this big sign and we're going to pay them money and we've signed a contract and everybody's approved and then they change their mind and we said you can't sue them.
Well, it's according to my pleadings in this case is that it's an illegal act of a board.
Well, why wasn't it illegal in federal sign? I mean, it wasn't illegal like they stole or they... You just mean it's illegal, like you don't like it. They breached the contract, which is what Federal Sign said, too.
No, I seriously, this is illegal.
They didn't violate any criminal law. When you say illegal, you don't mean criminal law.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, I don't.
Which one?
Pardon me, what?
Which one? You're telling me, yes, oh, no, I'm insisting it's legal. Okay, how?
Under the statute? That's my argument.
Peter Moore.
No, the board already made a determination that she was entitled to 100%.
And Federal Sign made a determination they would buy this sign. How is what they did any less illegal than what you're saying occurred here?
Can't answer your question.
No question you want her to get paid. Isn't this a suit for money damages?
Well, you know, pension boards, they don't give out food. They don't give out vehicles. They just have dollars. And so when someone's entitled to a dollar, you're taking their money away from them. So it's just like if you were to give out food or give out cars, what's the difference?
So
we're not going to give you out your car anymore. It's personal property.
You know, the problem is we've said you can't sue them for money damages. I mean, that's what the Williams case and lots of others before it say, that if you're what you're wanting is a government entity to pay you, then you can't just bring suit. You've got to go ask the legislature first.
There's the old Epperson case. The old Epperson case was a contract dispute where someone had earned money, and there was a suit against the taxing authority because they were there to collect taxes, and it was a suit for money. It was earned income pursuant to a contract. It was a breach of contract, and the court said, well, it is money damages, yes, but it was for earned in the past. And that's why they're entitled to collect it.
How does that survive Federal Sign? I mean, the deal was they started building the sign, so they had earned it.
I think that when you take some property away from someone, that they already have received it. Federal Sign doesn't even apply. I think that in this situation, those funds, 100%, one-third of the funds that were paid to Ms. Heiner, with her money, whether it's money, whether it's cars, whether it's food, regardless of how you characterize the personal property that was taken away from her, it's an equitable remedy, and she's asking for that which belongs to her to be returned. And whether it's a constitution or an illegal or an ultra-virus act, these are things that belong to her.
And how is that different from everybody else with a contract claim against the state?
Well, I'd have to look at all the other people that have contract cases. I mean, there are people that you have a contract case with the states that you can sue.
I mean, you're saying because we've got a contract, then all the money she would be paid under that contract in the future are her funds, as soon as the contract's
signed. I'm not so sure I said there's a contract. I'm sure that what had happened is that her husband paid into a fund for 16 years before he got shot and eventually died. And a board decided that she should be entitled to 100%, which I'm assuming is a legal act. And now, on down the road, years later, another board decides that it's not. And our position is that we should be able to litigate the issue of whether or not it was a legal act. And we claim that it is. And we also claim that their actions were illegal, that they took it away from her without the right. And that's the position.
I understand, but this is an old, old part of the law, that in a free society, that one legislature can't bind a future legislature's hands. The one board can't bind a future board's hands. And one city council can't bind a future city council's hands. So the law in America has been for at least 100 years. The whole idea behind that democratic principle is that a government, as constituted one day, that promises a citizen something, when they get voted out, they're not bound by what the dead hand of the former legislature said. It sounds to me you're saying exactly that. You're wanting us to ignore a whole lot of law. and saying this board is bound by the hand of the former board. And I need some specific authority before I go that far.
Well, I don't necessarily agree with the characterization being put upon this set of circumstances. I'm trying to wrestle with you what you're putting forward. And what I would say is this. It's a question of entitlement. This recipient of the pension benefits are entitled. It was illegally taken away from her. They did. It's not a question of going in and contracting with someone else to build this office building, or starting anew. This is something that happened in the past, and I don't particularly agree that this is new legislation that's being made by a new city council. The problem is a new city council should honor contracts made in the past by prior city council, and I'm sure they could break these contracts, but that gives rise to a cause of action for breach of contract. That isn't what we're here about. What I think we're here about is that these funds were her funds legally, and they've been taken away.
Just a declaratory judgment does not benefit you any. You want a judgment declaring and a judgment that your client is entitled to money. Is that correct? Let me phrase that a little different way. Is there any judgment you're seeking whatsoever that does not include a judgment awarding your client money?
You know, I'd like to disagree with you.
No, I'm asking you.
Well, I know. I'd like to say no, but the problem is, what do you receive from a pension? What can you receive other than an allotment every month in the form of money?
Declaration is not. You're not seeking any type of declaration that does not award you your client money.
Well, in a sense, we are, and that would be the entitlement to 100%. As opposed to 66 2/3,
all right,
would eventually compute into dollars.
So how do you get the dollars?
Well, we have to get the judgment, and then enjoin them from keeping it, and it's an unjust enrichment.
Okay, so you want the judgment and an injunction in the same effect. Net bottom line is the declaratory judgment does not do you any good without the injunctive relief telling them to pay it. Is that
enjoining them from withholding it?
All right, that's the future.
That's correct. Actually, and for percentages that they've held in the past. See, they've been withholding since 2003.
Right.
So we have to have a declaratory judgment allowing us within the statute that the actions of the board in 1985 were correct, and an injunction enjoining them from keeping what they took away from her in the past and the future.
Are you interested in any wise in a declaratory judgment that does not include injunctive relief?
No.
So I'm a little confused, so bear with me. Do you accept or reject the state's view that your case can be divided into two parts, prospective relief and retroactive relief?
I believe that the case can be divided into two portions, prospective and retroactive.
So collecting on money past due, separate and apart from moving forward, directing the city to abide by the initial agreement.
Well, I think it has to be like that. I think, which brings up a whole host of questions, looking at me kind of.
How do we? No. I'm just trying to. If we enjoin them and say, pay this amount in the future, and they don't, then we're going to have to throw them all in jail.
if that's what y'all want to do, I mean,
well, I mean, this is why we this is why we avoid sovereign immunity, because if we tell them to do something and they say no, then precisely what is a court going to do? Well, the answer, well, we'll foreclose on the Capitol building. We'll slap a lien on the big pink building.
Then I mean, the other thing to do if that happens is, of course, the plaintiff or Ms. Heinrich would go to the legislature and ask for further relief. But you see, the problem I had...
Which she could do now.
Of course she could. I mean...
Why do you need a deck action before you go over and ask the legislature? I mean, I don't understand them to be saying... They can't sue us even if they get the legislature's permission. I understand them to be saying she has to get the legislature's permission first, so why don't you go get that?
Well, you know, I have a real problem with the old concept of English law is you just can't send the sheriff out and pick up somebody's property without due process, without a warrant. I have a real problem with that. You know, this is not the king sending the sheriff of Nottingham or so whatever to go out and pick up people's property or collect money. And in my, you know, humble or not so humble opinion, that's exactly what happened here. The board has made a decision. There's no argument. You either do what we say, or that's it. And you can't sue us, even if it's illegal, even if it's unconstitutional. And I have a hard time with that.
And Williams. We remanded the case, like several others, to consider changes in the local government code that waived immunity for some claims against local governments. You familiar with that?
Yeah.
Do you think you have a claim under those statutes?
I don't think the local government code would apply to this situation.
Why not?
Well, it just doesn't apply. I mean, this is an equitable remedy for an illegal act. I don't think the government code goes to that.
So those sections, which are sections 271.151 to 160, those were the amendments about 4 or 5 years ago that waived immunity for some claims against local governments. You don't plan to sue under those statutes?
No, I don't.
Sorry?
I don't.
And the amendment in the last session that's been discussed in the briefs. You're familiar with that?
Yes.
How do you think it applies?
No, I don't. If anyone
that was House Bill 1473.
That's correct. Can I give you guys some time back?
No further questions. You surely may. Thank you, counsel. Court will hear rebuttal.
Please, the court. First of all, I think the respondent's argument, candid argument, that conceding that he really his only sole remedy here is money damages. There is no basis here for a declaratory claim independently here of a order compelling the fund essentially to pay either past or future monies. I think that falls squarely within governmental immunity under this court's case law, and therefore immunity from suit bars the claim, and it should be dismissed with prejudice. I think it should be dismissed with prejudice because there is no way to amend the petition, which he'd amended a couple of times already, in an effort to evade immunity in a way that could viably go forward in the absence of a legislative waiver of immunity from suit.
I suppose you don't think the changes to the local government code apply here either.
They don't, Your Honor, and I can say specifically that the 271 section of government code applies to municipalities and schools and certain limited agencies of which the pension fund is not included. So on its face of the statute, we're not subject to that limited waiver of immunity within that statute, first of all. And that, by the way, that I think that section illustrates why it is appropriate that the legislature be the ones to waive the immunity. That statute has limitations upon the damages that can be recovered for breach of contract. It says, for example, you can't recover lost profits. That's one of the limitations. It says you can only recover attorney's fees if they're spelled out in the contract. You can cover attorney's fees. So one of the reasons why under our system that the court directs litigants to go to the legislature is because it's within the legislature's province to define the scope of the remedies that are available to the litigant against the government entity in protection of the government's funds, and here are the pension funds.
And what's your view of House Bill 1473?
No, that wouldn't apply here either, Your Honor, to the circumstances of this case or the pension fund or its statutory obligations. To follow up on where some of the courts have gone off track on in terms of awarding declaratory relief against governmental entities that as to future monies, I think that what has happened is they've pulled a sentence out of the IT Davy case. There's a sentence in there that says that because suits to compel state officers to act within their official capacity they don't subject the state to liability. And so they've gone on to say that, well, we can construe a statute in the future that would have the effect of causing a government entity to pay money. Respectfully, this sentence, if you put it in context, it's in the context of the cases discussed in IT Davy. It's in that paragraph discussing Cobb v. Harrington and a case, again, where it was purely equitable declaration as to whether or not the petitioner was a motor carrier. It didn't have anything to do with the payment of money. And so if you put that statement in context, it is referring specifically to those types of circumstances where someone is burdened by a statute and wants a declaration concerning its applicability or meaning to them, as opposed to a case like this where someone is seeking to compel their view of the state law in a way that requires the payment of money damages like this. So that vein of cases and that sentence taken out of context do not support an injunctive or declaratory relief in the future.
Does the court concern itself at all with the mischief that would happen if we say a body can promise to pay and that a plaintiff can rely on that promise to their detriment, and then the governmental unit can take it away some years later? We have said it's a legislator's province, but we've also not completely given up on the idea that the court might intervene when necessary.
Well, I think that the structure that the court has set up is working. The court has stated that it is the legislature's job to define the circumstances in which the inherent governmental immunity from suit is waived. And the legislature has taken that into account and is acting on it. And as the court has pointed out with these two recent statutes, has defined the specific circumstances under which that immunity from suit will be waived and the scope of that waiver. And I think that system is working. And the court is acting responsibly in the way that it's interpreting those duties.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes arguments for the day, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.